Today is the 7th of May, 2013. This is the second interview session with Dr. Mario Molina here at the Mario Molina Center in Mexico City. I'm David Caruso. Here with me is Jody Roberts, and also joining us is Lorena Gonzalez. So I think, Jody, you wanted to pick up with some questions about where we left off yesterday.
Sure, thank you. You did a really lovely and succinct closing yesterday around the work that you did with Sherry Rowland, but we didn't poke at it too much.
Okay.
And
okay.
I obviously wanted to spend some time today fleshing that out
more,
getting your thoughts on some of the things that happened. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about the reaction more and dive mm-hmm. more into the reaction. You made a few comments yesterday about, you know, you don't go to graduate school and learn how to do public communication.
That's right.
And you suddenly found yourself in need of public communication. But I don't want to constrain how we think about this. I wanted to just maybe get your thoughts first on how you experienced, how you reacted to the reception to the work that you and Professor Rowland had done.
Yes, perhaps repeating a little bit what I said here yesterday, but expanding it also. Again, we had, as expected, sort of a mixed reaction, first within the scientific community. As I mentioned yesterday, the colleagues of the other scientists that we felt were familiar with the field and so on, they immediately sort of supported us, and so that it was reassuring. Okay, it was fine, but again, with the rest of the scientific community, some thought maybe we were exaggerating or just trying to make noise in some way or other. And a similar thing happened with the media. There were a few reporters, and then eventually a couple of people that were even writing books that came a little later, so we had some more thorough, long interviews with a few of them, and with reporters in general, we just had to sort of summarize things. But it, as expected, there were a number of criticism in the press, and that this was sort of far-fetched and so on. But others immediately received it as something potentially quite important. And we were, of course, stressing this at the very beginning. This was just a hypothesis and it had to be tested. But it didn't take long to learn to that we had to communicate with the media in a different language and trying to set up the sort of the background information or to put things in context. Okay? So overall, I remember just making an effort. We have to spend some time. But we felt that it was overall reasonably well accepted, considering that there was relatively little precedent for this. It was, of course, at that time, with the environmental movement was sort of taking off. But most of it, if not all of it, was talking about local pollution, water or air or whatever. So this, what was new with this problem that we were dealing with was that it was a truly a global issue, and so there was really no precedent for that. So it didn't matter where these things were emitted, and so that's the way.
So before you published the paper, did you anticipate what the response might be?
Well, yes, but with a lot of uncertainty. Okay,
yeah.
We thought, well, it's it since this is an industrial compound and it's is used in, I remember it, practically every household had. We were told some statistics later, 30 to 40, remember, 40 maybe, but at least 20 to 30 spray cans on the average in each American household. So at that time, everything was spray. So everybody had some contact with it, of course, refrigerators and so on. So we thought, yes, well, this must make some noise. And in some sense, we were sort of disappointed that nothing happened at the beginning because it was just too strange or so. And then little by little, it became better known. And also, as we anticipated, there were objections, but insulting in any way, but the industry people were saying, well, this is not necessarily putting it down as something ridiculous, but saying this is not proven at all, so we want there's no need to stop this because this is just a hypothesis, so it would not be correct to try now to do something about it. But I do remember a few strange instances. You know, there is a magazine which is called, I don't know if it's the same, Aerosol Age or so, but it was devoted to spray cans. And of course now we get, many years afterwards, we get along extremely well with them. They replace things and so on. So I even, just recently, I just pointed out because they invite me to some of their functions and so on, so that's fine. But early on, there was somebody's article claiming that this was, what was it? This was some sort of conspiracy that had connections with, what was it? With the Soviet Union, something very strange. Yes, as you know, this is clearly something that we wanted to attack American culture, okay? So, and it made some news. So it was sort of funny because it didn't have any more consequences. But as always, there are people that really get annoyed at these things. I think they think all these environmental issues, it's just people that want to, they're probably communists and they want. They have there's a political agenda and so on. Mm-hmm. So
was there ever any concern about that because you were not an American?
No, not that I. I never became aware of anything like that. Mm-hmm. No. We were scientists, and I imagine it's in the scientific community. It's common enough to have all sorts of strange names that it never came up to my attention. Talking about names, it was something funny, but that happened a little later. We began to talk to people in Congress, first in California, but then we traveled a little bit and so on. When you were saying about names, there was a bill introduced, I believe it was in Congress. Tom DeLay, of course, is still around, so he was pretty much. But the two congressmen that introduced it were DeLay and Doolittle. So that's why he stuck in my mind. They say they introduced the bill, that this nothing had to be done about these issues.
It's interesting. I was about to ask you how it came about that you started to testify in these national and state legislatures. Was that something that you were asked to do? Is that something that you took up on your own?
No, it's something I believe resulted from the news media, and what it did I mean, we have to respond with other words, but I don't remember either Sherry or us sort of taking the initiative to call any. We were not connected at all with the with politicians in either a state level or so. So it's something that just happened, and a few politicians were sort of sympathetic to the environmental movement or had some reasons to worry about spray cans or whatever. So and again, we realized we had to put things in context and be clear. Though we didn't do that very explicitly, but it was clear that we could have easily sort of exaggerated or made ourselves part of just the environment in general. And so we really wanted to stick to the science, of course, realizing that policy has to be made, but we only wanted to state what are the risks or what happens and so on and so forth, and not be perceived as advocates for a particular environmental cause. But nevertheless, I mean, it's something that Sherry and I did, but Sherry did very explicitly that sort of became quoted often, quite often, but much later, that if not us, who, and if not now, when, or so. So because that's the other sort of thing that happened at the beginning, I remember, which was, there was, in the context of this environmental movement, there were already a number of environmental organizations, not as many as there are now, but they were all so far removed from these issues that we did not have support or communicate with any of these existing organizations at the beginning. Then later on, after probably some of the National Academy reports and so on, then several organizations approached us, and then we sort of were together more closely, but it was something that was not there at the beginning, so we did not have sort of, I mean, that would have been another option to just let somebody else do the sort of the politics, if you want, or the advertising, or in some sense, so it all sort of happened.
Did you have any support from the department or the university or just other colleagues in learning how to navigate the congressional or public face of the science?
No, that was interesting. That's what I remember. That's why we had this experience I told you about in the American Chemical Society. So we learned soon. But maybe in some conversations somewhere, but what I do remember is that in our community, which was not the environmental community, that this was a sort of academia, so this was quite unusual. I mean, there were no similar issues. Perhaps the closest thing was we did not immediately learn from that, but the closest thing was the supersonic transport issue, and the way that worked, Hal Johnston and so on, they were also well-respected scientists who were not sort of going out and advocating things. And but there were sort of mostly scientific meetings, which were some of them a little bit more open, like to people in the medical community or so. But I don't remember sort of learning anything other than the science itself, you know, from colleagues.
Mm-hmm. How was it, I know in 75 you became a professor at Irvine, right? So you're
right.
Transitioning from this postdoc. How was it balancing these outside activities with establishing yourself as a professor in the U.S.?
It was, I remember, a little bit of a risk, because Sherry was already established. He, of course, complained later. I didn't see that personally. He complained later that for I don't know how many years he did not get any more applications from postdocs, for example. So he was clearly noticing that in his position, because he was the chairman of the, he sort of established the chemistry department there, he did notice that this contrast that I was telling you about, that our close colleagues very much in agreement with us, but the community in general looking at this as with a lot of reservations. Okay, I had no problems. I got graduate students, which I wasn't expecting, postdocs anyhow. And fortunately, although it's a time where you have to work very hard to get your tenure and so on, but in general did not have much of a conflict in terms of time, because what took most time, some of the interviews were of the several books that were written and so on, but we thought that was very worthwhile, so that was okay. No? And so there were three or four books that appeared on the overall issue, interviewing Sherry and myself and sometimes other scientists as well. No? But yeah, no, there was no, I had no problem myself that I perceived in terms of the rest of the community, perhaps because I was mostly interacting again with colleagues I already knew or the colleagues that were involved in the field and so on. Or in the, we certainly had the support, but informally, there was no formal support. But at Irvine, of course, the chemistry department, and so they knew Sherry and knew myself, so that we had no problems with our close colleagues. Okay, this was more the, perhaps the community at large. Yeah.
Thinking about the tenure process, I think you might have mentioned something yesterday about the concerns with staying on at the same university where you're doing your postdoc, making sure that your science is distinct from the person that you were previously working with.
Right.
How did you and Dr. Rowland separate that out? Or was it not really an issue?
It was not an issue because we did not have to separate anything in connection with the communication aspects to the public or to the media or to other colleagues and so on. What we really had to separate was just purely the scientific work. I had to write papers where I was the main author with my students, and Sherry continued his research writing his own papers. We had a few joint papers and so on, which I knew they were not going to count for the tenure process because of the question of, these things were a little exaggerated, okay, because afterwards being myself a professor and analyzing tenure cases, you can sometimes tell, even though there are close collaborations, you can still make a judgment of whether somebody was just following somebody else or his contribution. But anyhow, we took it very seriously. And there was no problem because I was using different experimental techniques. And so even if we at some point were looking at similar systems, it was with a very different laboratory approach. So that turned out not to be a problem. In fact, at some stage, I remember one important issue that came later is the realization that reactions on particles were going to be very important in the, that was some years later, in the polar stratosphere, and we both sort of came up with a, we knew that was the case, but we had very different experimental approaches to the same question. So in summary, it was really no conflict in terms of separating what was scientific research from our joint role there as a spokesman, we want for this issue. And I do remember things, but sort of in some sense simplified when the community took it seriously enough, as I mentioned to you yesterday, that the National Academy started to do reports, and of course that was then a clear signal that this was an issue recognized by the community as something worthwhile to further analyze. And we thought, oh, that's terribly important, because this is one way to communicate this issue to the public in which it will be clear that it is not advocacy, that it's not because we came up with this idea and hence we were blindly just pushing it. This happened all, I don't remember that, I probably should have looked at the dates and so on, but in any event, early on, if not the first, maybe the second report or so, rather early, along these lines that I was telling about, that I was doing my own research, I pursued the chemistry further and finding out what are the likely chemical reactions that would take place. And so I came up, this is something I did independently of Sherry, of course, we were working closely anyhow, but that was more part of my line of research, to identify some chemical species that were sort of new. Mm-hmm. And so it turns out one very important one came later, that's a chlorine peroxide, that was to explain the stratospheric ozone hole. That came much later. But very early on, I realized that there was one species which is called chlorine nitrate, that I thought this might be quite important because it's relatively unusual in that it doesn't absorb light very strongly, hence it might build up somewhat in the stratosphere. But it was a very weird species. I realized that at least the chemical compound existed, in contrast to the other one, the chlorine peroxide, that had not been characterized, so because it's not stable at room temperature. So with the new techniques, and I was able to show, yeah, this molecule not only exists, but will be there in significant amounts. But this other one, yeah, it had already been characterized, but in a very obscure paper in the German literature by some German professor. Yes, nobody had paid any attention, but I found it and then began to do experiments. And then, of course, the National Academy report went on, and first I talked to Cher, said, well, we have to let them know because this is something that we need to find out more about this species to be able to quantify, to better quantify how much ozone will be depleted and so on, because it has a complex role in my slow it down. And it was interesting because it caused a big uproar, because some of the models at that time were still relatively simple, mm-hmm. and the simple models, just putting these species in, say, wow, there's no more ozone depletion, practically very little. So this sort of stopped that second National Academy report, or I don't remember which one was it, and sort of delayed things, and then later it became clear it was just, yes, it had to be considered, it might delay things a little bit, but the ozone depletion was still important. So it's just one example. But ironically, years later, this was much later when the Antarctic ozone hole appears, that turned out to be a crucial species to explain polar ozone depletion. So you see historically how that sort of came about. But this is an illustration of this, the different lines of research. And I was able to, with my students, of course, to make the species, to synthesize this in the laboratory, take spectra, and so on and so forth. It's a very unstable species with surfaces, decomposes, and so on. But anyhow, those are the techniques I was sort of specializing on, to work with rather unstable species that are, you can't handle just conventional, just bulk vessels to look at them.
So is this one of the reasons that the National Academies decided to actually do two reports? So in going back and checking some of our notes last night, they decided to do a report earlier that basically confirms that, you know, what you and Sherry observed is observable and sound.
Right.
But they postponed doing a report that really started to talk about the larger chemistry and the implications of that chemistry.
I think that was it, yes.
Okay.
But eventually they did the report, and so it just, essentially, the if I remember correctly, the bottom line was, look, maybe ozone will not be depleted as fast as the simpler models would tell us, but it's still a big issue, and still we need to do experiments in the atmosphere and so on. So that was the consequence of this, making the chemistry more complete.
You mentioned that Roland had some difficulty attracting some postdocs for a short time. Did you have any difficulty attracting students to your new lab?
No, because I was, in fact, I did work with, I had a few postdocs, and maybe I was lucky or so, but with graduate students that was less of a problem, because the graduate students are admitted and then they choose to work with somebody that is there. So I did not have much of a problem. And then at some point, that was later, I decided to concentrate more on research, less on teaching, and that's when I moved to the Jet Propulsion Labs. Mm-hmm. It was something sort of temporary, but there, of course, you have a lab work. And the other thing, that was, again, I have to look at the timing. But part of the reason is that as a professor in university, you hardly have time to do research in the laboratory yourself, whereas at the Jet Propulsion Labs and so on, many of the groups, it's just two or three people, and the main researcher is the one that is doing the experiments. But it's mixed. I had sort of several people working with me, but I was doing experiments myself as well, okay, which was sort of unusual. And then, of course, eventually I said, no, I to have a larger group, and I like teaching and so on, so I went to MIT, but that was later. But still, long before the Nobel Prize.
Sure. Yeah. Well, before we get to the JPL, I'm struck by the emphasis you've been putting on trying to dissociate the focus you wanted to maintain on the technical work. Mm-hmm. You know, there was still a lot of work to be done, and you've been talking about some of the work that you continue to do to clarify those original experiments and the original observations,
right.
And trying to separate that from the, you said, being a you know, a more public persona.
Right. Right.
But I'm thinking back to the again, going back and looking at some of the materials last night, the letter in Science in the year after your publication in Nature,
mm-hmm.
where you and Sherry are responding to an advertisement that DuPont has put into Science and a number of other magazines.
Okay.
And I'm wondering
about
the experience of trying to respond in a technical manner to an advertisement,
right,
inside the pages of Science, and
yes,
and the response by DuPont on a technical way to your letter in response to an advertisement,
right,
in response to
yeah,
because their response seems to be jumbling the world in a way that you're trying to keep more neatly cut.
Yes. Okay. Let me explain part of that. I had forgotten about that letter even, but I need to go back and look at it because it was fun. Here is what was peculiar and contrasting this is yet another issue, because as you know, more recently I've done a lot more with climate change, so I can see the differences. But one thing that was different then, and that's why I brought the climate change issue, is that DuPont, that was the largest chemical company, they had a tradition of doing scientific research. They were funding scientific research, much of it with polymers, of course, that was applied, but they were very proud of expanding that to the point that they had people publishing in the scientific literature, so it was not all applied just for the company. So we were dealing with a company that was proud of their acceptance of science as an important issue and so on. So in some sense, that's why this sort of initial friction was unique, because if it was just like this other magazine just attacking, just that we didn't pay that much attention, but with DuPont, we felt that we had to be more responsive along the science itself. Okay. We were not necessarily pushing, that's clear. I think Sherry also, we were not pushing for political responses also. We were at that stage just trying to make the science clear, recognizing that, of course, experiments still had to be done, but that what our statements were that, look, it is sound, and the uncertainties need to be sorted out by experience, but it's certainly a serious issue. We think this is potentially very serious, so we feel a responsibility to communicate this to society and so on. So I don't remember the details, but it was, we were not really, how should I put it, at least personally, any bad terms with DuPont. We were just fighting at the scientific level. But it was then much clearer afterwards. Again, although I don't remember the dates very well, the way industry responded through the CMA, the Chemical Manufacturers Association, DuPont playing, of course, a very important role, they decided to fund scientific research. So they put money into funding research on the chemistry of the stratosphere. Okay? Because inside DuPont, they did not have experts in this field. They eventually hired, much later, I don't remember when, Mac McFarland, which was a very well-respected researcher in our community, whose expertise was measuring nitrogen oxides with balloons and so on. So with other words, DuPont did have, not too long after our initial announcement and so on, their own experts, scientists in this field that were working for DuPont, but not doing experiments. They were, however, funding our colleagues. Okay, they could write the proposals and so on. And so they had meetings, at least one annual meeting or sometimes several. And that's the one thing that Sherry and I were different. Sherry never went to those meetings. He was sort of on a personal level more in trouble, if you want, with this going. Whereas I was sort of accepted. I went to all these meetings. We did not have any problems. I just remember over the years that, gee whiz, they really have bad luck, because all the research that they were funding was supporting our ideas. But here is why I recognize DuPont. Of course, afterwards we became very good friends. DuPont in those years made the statement, should the science really prove to be correct, we will stop making these compounds. Okay. So what it took for them to recognize the sign was really much later, was the Antarctic ozone hole, where the sign was strikingly clear. And they did stop. Okay, and Mac McFarland was very instrumental in that. So we, with other words, I never had any personal conflict with them, and it was clear that they needed something. They were not about to stop producing chemicals just in case. They really wanted to make sure. By the way, there was a misunderstanding in general in the community also that DuPont stopped because they had developed replacements that would be very profitable. And so it turns out that that was not the case, not literal at least. There were only five large industries, four, five or six, Monsanto, some of the large chemical industries, and they did early on in their labs, that's the research they did was not the stratospheric chemistry, but are there other compounds that they could use? And so they did started to do some research on replacements. And then when things slow down, chlorinated and this sort of thing, they sort of stopped that. Okay. And they very much regretted that afterwards. They started that again. But no, they were earning money with the CFCs, and so they had to make a judgment. I knew this more or less, and because I trust Mike McFarland, and I don't remember the name of the post chairman at that time. Eventually became good friends. I'm bad for names, because later I became friend of the more recent chairmen of the bond, but I forget there was a key person at that time. Anyhow, I remember getting the inside stories that, look, we at DuPont had to make a decision eventually. First, we have made this commitment. Second, public relation is important for a company of our size and so on. So even if we're going to lose money because we had to stop this production, we thought that was still the right thing to do from a purely economics perspective, okay? Because they would lose sort of trust in the community and so on. And so that's, but then they did eventually develop replacements, and all of them did, and so it turns out that it was not a big issue in terms of a big economic loss, no? I'm making some remarks that happened much later, but I remember then DuPont became very proud, and we were of course proud as well, that it became an environmental company. Not just because they stopped making CFCs, but because they had a sort of a campaign with their staff and with the workers, and they are all very proud of being an environmental company. So we sort of turned that around, because initially they had no, I mean, they were making Teflon and so on, but most of the relations between a large chemical company and society were a bit more of friction in terms of what was the perception of chemistry is bad for the environment in general. Okay, so they that was one company that early on wanted to turn that sort of how do you call it? It's a misconception, or mm-hmm. I know that all chemistry is bad for you, and so we have to stop chemicals in general. But anyhow, this is sort of a description of the relation with industry. And with the news media, eventually, I guess what happened is that people that kept approaching us were self-selecting, the ones that believed that this was something to worry about, whereas the critics in general, where there were a number of exceptions, of course, but in general did not approach us. They simply wrote their opinions and so on. But occasionally, I remember having a few interviews which appeared friendly and just answering what appeared to be the science, and then the article was sort of completely negative, but it was not based on the science itself. It was just that. That's the sort of thing one expects from all different opinions in the media, and that happens.
What was driving the search for alternatives at DuPont at that point?
It was already, that's why I started early, it was already the recognition of, hey, we might have to stop. And not necessarily accepting the science or it was bad, but just looking at what society might do. Okay, this is a risk, and it's associated with public health, so we better put some money in finding something else, just in case. And of course, as the science became stronger, and obviously after when they decided to support the science, it became very obvious. Then it was really just to maintain. I mean, they had a big business and all the connections with the industry, and they knew a lot about it, and so they realized what would it take to make replacements. Okay. And so I presume that it was that those were the reasons. But initially, I would imagine it's just that they realized that this was something serious enough so that they would better do something just in case, I would imagine.
So I have one other question about the 70s, that larger context. So you are going to congressional hearings. You and Sherry are both testifying,
right,
both at state level and at national level. The 70s are the big, at least taken to be, the cauldron of the creation of environmental regulations, the environmental state,
right,
inside of the United States. But you also mentioned that the environmental movement really didn't know what to do with this. It was new, but
mm-hmm.
it was already pretty solidified by the time you're coming out with some of this,
right,
research.
Right.
And this isn't a locally produced
mm-hmm.
phenomenon. This is a dispersed phenomenon. This
right.
is a global phenomenon. So I'm curious where you fit, or how you were received in a little bit more detail, both by the regulatory community in,
mm-hmm.
in government.
Mm-hmm.
So you're having these congressional hearings, but I'm not sure if the people you're testifying before have an idea of where they're going to wedge this into the
yeah.
new matrix of environmental regulations that are out there, and how the environmental community is or is not responding. You've
yes.
addressed the latter a little bit.
Yes. I remember more or less what people in government, this congressman or so, thinking about regulations, they thought probably the spray cans was the weak point, because spray cans had also a bit of a bad name, but not for clear reasons. It was just because it was maybe considered to be a waste, or because we were using chemicals. Of course, we were in no way connected with that approach, but it was clear that was perhaps the easier target at the beginning. And in fact, that's what happened. In the environmental movement, spray cans got a bad name at that time. I remember one symptom of this is in TV there are these how do you call these? All in the Family was a very famous thing, and the young guy that appears there made some statements about not using spray guns. So that was a big thing, because that's
wow.
Because that's, of course, millions of people looking at that. So
yeah.
that was sort of publicity. But see, it was just spray guns in general, bad for you. Okay.
Yeah.
Ironically, there are still some people who still think that spray cans are bad for the environment, even though, of course, they don't use CFCs anymore. But it's a little bit that misconception. Okay. So that was the target, and in fact, the use of CFCs in spray cans was forbidden in the U.S. and in Canada. It was the first thing that happened, sort of quite separated from the later Montreal Protocol and the environmental agreements. Okay, so that's perhaps some of the environmental organizations then took that line as well. I remember I was a little uncomfortable with that. Say, well, sure, it's important for spray cans to switch propellants, but we have nothing against the use of spray cans in general. And in fact, I remember even talking something, for example, shaving cream does not use CFCs, they use nitrous oxide. this spray can is not no problem, and so on.
So,
but that was a dilemma, sort of, yeah.
Dave and I were talking about that on the drive over here this morning, the difficulty of conflating the specific for the general.
Right.
And so people's focus on the word aerosol.
Yeah.
When aerosol is a large category.
Exactly.
And very specific aerosols might be problematic, but you know, growing up and thinking about aerosol cans
yeah.
and that are explosive and they cause damage to the environment,
yeah.
And not an understanding of
right.
the
right.
differences of where, you know, again, the conflating of specifics in general.
That's right. Sure,
yeah.
sure. And that's typical, is one of the disadvantages of some environmental organizations, that they sort of a little bit blindly push some issues which are not very well supported by science.
Mm-hmm.
And that still happens. And of course, we know in recent times and so on, that actually backfires. So this, when people become more and more informed, these sort of things don't help.
Can you give an example?
Well, like this is more with much more recently with climate change, just not using anything but biofuels, but they could be economically just not practical yet at all. But I mean, they advocate a certain set of actions that are just not realistic, that there's no hope that society will do that, and there are more realistic, much better ways. There are reasonable ways to consider economic aspects and everything else, okay? But if, of course, the one organization that is sort of a stereotype of this is Greenpeace now, because they often exaggerate, and but there are others. But it's a little bit along those lines. And the position we had at that time, of course, it's still with climate change and so on, is that there are very rational ways in which society can respond to these things that are well justified, but not everything is well justified. In the, we're talking about biofuels. Biofuels can be very badly misused as well. If you do away with tropical forests just to make biofuels, that's a disaster. That's just one example, but at that time, the spray can issue was the clear one. Okay, no, look, there are spray cans that are all right, or if you replace, if you use hydrocarbons or whatever, then it's all right. Then there might be other issues, but they are not, it has nothing to do with the global issue.
So there's a lot of momentum building up here at the end of the 70s. You've got two National
right.
Academy reports.
Right, right.
You know, you're revising a lot of your own research. You've been
right.
going off on your own trend. And there seems to be some recognition, at least in some of the reflective pieces that you wrote in the 90s, about the great halt that happens because of the change in political climate.
Right,
and,
right.
And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the change from the 70s to the 80s.
Here is what I remember. That those were a little bit frustrating times, because we had initially, of course, this, as we were talking about, at the very beginning, the issue was not recognized, too strange. But then it was essentially sort of accepted by society. With industry, we had these relations. I wouldn't even call them fights, but the science was still moving along. And it was a little bit more complicated than we anticipated at the beginning. And so we realized, well, it's not likely that you will notice a very striking effect in the next few years, because that's what the model tells us, and there are these complications. So this might take a decade or two. Okay, so things slow down, and so we're a little bit frustrated, but decided, well, we just have to keep doing research. It did not receive as much public attention as it did at the beginning. And so that's the way things were moving until the Antarctic ozone hole appeared, of course. Just about the same time also, there were indications that ozone depletion at mid-latitudes and so on was also measurable. Mm-hmm. But at the very beginning, it was clear that, yeah, we were not expecting ozone depletion to be measurable because the large fluctuation. So that was, if you want, uncomfortable times in terms of knowing that not much was going to happen until we could prove to society that something really worrisome was actually happening. The threat of something worrisome happening in the future was not enough to move the international community beyond the US and Canada having banned the CFCs in spray cans and so on. And so that's why things changed quite dramatically, if you want, with the Antarctic ozone hole. So I can tell you about that if you want a little bit. But that happened already. So that was in the early 80s. Okay? And it was quite interesting because we learned from Joe Farman, who was the head of the British Antarctic Survey, because he approached us. He was one of those, you know, there are all sorts of types of scientists like to do all sorts of strange measurements, and you needed very dedicated scientists to spend the night in Antarctica, because many months, but they were measuring stratospheric ozone levels, still with the motivation, like in Switzerland, of course, I remember also they had some long sort of chain of measurements from the Alps in Switzerland, all to trying to learn how ozone moves in the stratosphere, as we talked about yesterday briefly, just to learn about how the atmosphere of our planet functions, the chemistry not being terribly important. Anyhow, so that was essentially the motivation of these ground measurements, where you can measure ozone from the ground because it's the only species absorbing ultraviolet light. So you just measure how much ultraviolet light gets to the ground and you get the measurement how much ozone there is. And so it was interesting to see, it was interesting to measure over the poles because enough was understood that ozone is made in the tropics, but then it's at higher altitudes and it moves to lower altitudes and it ends up piling up over the poles. Okay, so it gives you a lot of information of the movements which are different in the stratosphere. And so Joe Farman and his team, two other colleagues and so on, they didn't believe it, that there was practically very little, practically no ozone, but they were able to see. They didn't approach us immediately. It took them several years, because at the beginning it was normal, and then it began to disappear. And so they approached, hey, could this be connected to the CFCs? And in fact, they wrote a paper when they announcing their findings, suggesting, to their credit, because it was not suggesting, it could be the CFCs, when in fact, the rest of the community of the atmosphere, these were not atmospheric chemists, but were mostly the people studying the atmosphere, the stratosphere, and so on. They all thought, this must be natural. How can this possibly have something to do with CFCs? Because it is spectacular. I mean, something very big is happening. And then one question was, well, we have been measuring ozone for years with satellites. So are these guys wrong? So they went back. The results were there. But the satellites had been programmed to ignore the data. So it was very striking, but immediately became, of course, a big issue. Of course, the satellite also corroborates this. What the hell is going on? So then it really took just a few years then. But at the beginning, a very skeptical community, and then say, well, if it's chlorine, we should be able to measure that. So that's when the ground expedition went with Susan Solomon measuring things from the ground. And already say, wow, it appears that it's quite possible and even likely that it is in fact chlorine from the CFCs. And then a few years later with Jim Anderson and the ER2, which is the sort of a cousin of the U2, the plane that had been developed to spy over Russia. And you remember Gary Powell was shot down and there was a big scandal, of course. So fortunately those planes, with little modifications, could be used to, it was a very daring thing, but could be used to fly over Antarctica because at high altitudes. But it was very daring because if there was no place to, if there, any emergency and the pilot was gone, and low temperatures, the fuel begins to get more and more viscous and so on. But fortunately they said, well, let's plan, let's do it. And these crucial experiments were done, eh? Yeah. And the first,
I love those things.
Yeah.
yeah, because we were of course fascinated and expecting this. They were flying from southern Chile, from Punta Arenas, taking off all the way to Antarctica. I said, will we hear anything else from the pilots? But they were able to return. The first two flights, the instruments didn't work, but then the results came, the smoking going, okay. So those were the very clear, very, very clear results, measuring chlorine and chlorine oxide with instruments that were similar to the ones we had used in the laboratory, but that was Jim Anderson's specialty, and measuring ozone, okay? And so what was very revealing is, of course, once you reach the ozone hole, practically no ozone and a lot of chlorine. But the walls, the ozone was sort of going up and down, and chlorine up and down, just like a mirror image. The perfect anti-correlation. Okay. Mm. So how can this possibly be by chance? No. So I remember Jim Anderson sending us, probably to Sherry and to me, a very nicely framed sort of picture with these curves, okay, before and after. So that's the smoking gun. Mm. And so that's the sort of thing. I mean, of course, many more experiments were done and other species were measured as well. And of course, we had more to learn about really how the chemistry worked. But that's the sort of thing that then changed industry's perspective. But we still had to do some work. The chemistry was not clear, so that's when we did some additional laboratory work with these other species to explain, no, this is very unique chemistry that speeds up at very low temperatures. Other species are involved, like this chlorine peroxide and so on. So that was complemented by this laboratory work.
So how difficult was it to maintain support and funding for this work during that first half of the 80s?
Fortunately, it was once the Antarctic, there was some funding all the time for the balloons, okay? And so NASA was funding these sort of things, but it was initially like any sort of fundamental research activity, just let's learn more about the atmosphere and so on, and with no practical connection. Fortunately, that's basic science, that's what I did, and it was not terribly expensive. Mm. But people had to send these helium balloons, and there was a specialty, and eventually they were sending some from Antarctica as well, but that was not the main part. It was realized there we really had to send airplanes. But when the Antarctic ozone hole appeared, and because we already had a whole decade, or if not more, of knowing that the CFCs were in fact there, they were decomposing and so on, so there was it was not terribly expensive research, so there was no issue. NASA essentially had the funding to do this.
I was going to say, it sounds like very expensive research to me. If you're flying a U-2 over Antarctica, I bet that's not cheap.
But
you were taking advantage of resources and monitoring or observatory work that was already taking place.
That's right. If you consider other NASA projects, going to the moon or sending telescopes or so, this was not expensive, okay, in that context. And they had the excuse, hey, this is something that we need to find out because it could be very worrisome for society. So at that time, I remember NASA had no particular funding problem, so that was not an issue. And the planes were there. I mean, it's not that they had to construct them, but it was obviously they still had to spend a fair amount of money compared to just doing laboratory research. You know?
I'm thinking of the Reagan context and thinking about the scrutiny that executive administration is bringing to federal funding more generally.
Right.
And trying to figure out if it was accidental or strategic on your part that you were doing a lot of this work inside of one of the few agencies that was not under quite the same amount of scrutiny that others. I mean, this, if
right.
this were work being done by
yeah.
the Challenger.
Right, and so
things change.
Change right after the Challenger.
Right. It's probably not something we did very consciously, but the community, mm-hmm. the community was very much aware of that. It was reasonable for mm-hmm. for NASA to fund. In fact, with Reagan, I remember one of his close friends was Rudolf Aplanap. I mean, a very wealthy guy, had made a lot of money because he invented the spray can valve. So he was in a bind. Eventually, Reagan came around, and so the Montreal Protocol and all that with Margaret Thatcher and so on. So that all happened afterwards, okay? Right. But it was a fight initially. You were right. So that was quite interesting how things changed. And in fact, at that time, there were Republicans in Reagan and so on in power in the presidency, and they were the environmentalists at the time. Okay, mm-hmm. So things did change quite a bit. The Cleaner Act was also showing up at that time. But yes, there were these general problems that you mentioned. Yeah. But NASA, fortunately, NASA continued with funding laboratory work and so on. That was not a major part of the research for a while.
So a lot of this work is going on also while you're at Caltech. And you'd mentioned, I think, that part of your reason for that move was you wanted to do a bit more research than you were able to do at Irvine. I'm also curious, I mean, you were in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, mm-hmm. So I'm guessing things are a little different from where you were at Irvine in terms of the colleagues that you have around you. You had a supportive community at Irvine. Did you have the same sort of support from your colleagues while you were at JPL?
Yes, because in fact, JPL, just again being NASA funded and so on, was doing a whole variety of things. Of course, the main activity was that's what JPL does, is known for, is the unmanned vehicles that they send to explore the solar system. So that whenever something happened, that was a very, very big. But they funded a number of other research activities. One was connected with the Earth's atmosphere. So we were a group of maybe five or six atmospheric chemists doing laboratory research on trying to better understand the atmosphere. And at that time, yeah, they decided, okay, it's reasonable to fund and to do stratospheric research. So that was the main focus of this group. In contrast, if you want to what was going on at several other universities, which was more air pollution research. That's another branch of atmospheric sciences, if you want. But yes, this group of, I remember, well, all friends of mine are very well known and so on, we were all doing work in the laboratory to understand chlorine chemistry, mm-hmm. perhaps some nitrogen oxide chemistry as well, and so on.
So was this something you sought out, or were you recruited to come up to the JPL?
No, since the community is small and so on, when I expressed sort of my willingness to move away from Irvine to university, then this came about. I don't remember the details, but since I knew the people, it was relatively easy to do.
Were there any of your colleagues or any former students or anybody like that that you took with you, or was this a kind of a solo transition?
No, it was a solo. Well, my ex-wife was working with me, so obviously she... But no, when she went there, she actually worked with somebody else at JPL. So she did not join my group, although later on at MIT, we still did some work. At MIT, she was, in fact... part of my group, or eventually essentially just managing things, but with she still did experimental work in the early years. But as I was mixed up now, because at JPL I was working with a couple of postdocs. I mean, there you don't have graduate students, obviously, but these essentially people or students that function like postdocs. So they already have a PhD and they just spend what is understood to be a temporary position.
I was curious just a little bit, since you brought up about the overlap with your first wife, mm-hmm. because she seems to be a co-author on a lot of your
right.
work. Was that an area that she was working in when you guys were both at Berkeley, or did her career research tack towards yours? And
no, he tacked towards mine afterwards, because if you remember, I mentioned yesterday that our mentor, George Pimentel, was very well known, but he had two big research areas where he was well known. One was a chemical laser one, and the other one was the low temperature spectroscopy. And so Luisa, my ex-wife, was actually in the other
okay.
field. But then when she essentially, perhaps starting at JPL, but then at MIT, she just, it was all still very much laboratory type work. With vacuum lines, and so it was not a big jump in any way. To
it would actually seem like her skill set in low temperature spectroscopy perhaps even came in handy.
That's
as
right.
We were transitioning towards different modes of monitoring some of the chemical species.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And we were. That's one thing that was also functioned well at JPL, since we were few and working together, we could learn from each other and borrow equipment and so on and so forth. So that worked reasonably well there. There was also, it's just a side issue, but what was centered at JPL, starting at that time, was a major effort for the group of experts, in this case, not experts in general on the stratosphere, but on stratospheric chemistry, to evaluate the results of the community. In this case, just to very pure chemistry. What does this group recommend should be the rate constants, and what should be the reactions that matter? Okay, so we spent quite a bit of time. We had to study and look at the publications and look at all the graphs, and eventually we had to recommend, okay, if you, for the modelers, because the modelers were not laboratory chemists, okay, so they used our output to feed the models. Okay.
So how sensitive were you about that issue around the models? Because that seemed to be at the heart of some of the disagreement and controversy in after the initial publications in the 70s.
Right.
So the difference between presenting results based on mathematical models and the presenting results based on experimentally verified laboratory
right.
results.
There was really never a real conflict, because we worked closely with the modelers. Some of them were, in fact, even at JPL, there was a group of maybe two modelers or so. So the good ones were also chemists, and they understood very well our recommendations and so on. And in parallel, we understood the nature of the models. Okay, so it's just that we were familiar with the limitations of the models as well. But there was no real, discrepancy or like two groups that we were working together. It's just that we could only do relatively simple models ourselves. I did some modeling early on when I was at Irvine, just to show that this thing would make sense. But then the models, the complicated models, were, of course, took a lot of computer time, and they were initially relatively simple, one-dimensional, and then got much more complicated, two-dimensional, and then eventually the three-dimensional. They just required a lot of computer time and space and so on. So that at that time it was really special that you couldn't do that mm-hmm. sort of on the side. And so we were able to work with the modelers and find out what the discrepancy. I remember now, just to make this more clear, I was forgetting there were three groups. The modelers, with the laboratory scientists, but then the measurement people. Okay, so essentially three different specialties, but with very close interactions and the well-recognized ones in each of the three specialties were sufficiently familiar with the other two so that we really had no conflict of sorts. In some sense, the models were also one way to raise questions. Of course, in the lab, if we came up with a new species, then obviously that had to be incorporated into the models, no? And measured also. Then the measurement people had to try to do that. But measurements and laboratory work was reasonably closely related. We were using very similar chemical technologies, one except, of course, in a balloon, they have to work without anybody touching anything. But so that's why that was really a specialty. But resonance, fluorescence, or spectroscopy, or whatever, so those were issues that we were all familiar with. Yeah, that's the way I would describe that. There was no real, I mean, when the time I described early, when the models came up with the second National Academy report and so on, we had realized, of course, when I came up and put in the models, that this could slow down the chemistry, because here we have what we call a reservoir species. It's a species that is holding some of the chlorine atoms in a form that is not destroying ozone. Okay. And so if that species were to be extremely stable, then very little would happen to ozone because the chlorine would always be tied up. But of course it was not perfectly stable, and it later, of course, realized it decomposed very fast on particles. So that's why in Antarctica, ozone hole, this species was so important. But in the normal atmosphere, it does decompose by photolysis only relatively slowly. So when I put it in my, if you want, I was able to do relatively simple mm-hmm. chemical modeling. What was more complicated is when you put it in the models, in particular, one dimension, like what was still able to do that, but then to see how far these things moved and so on. But the fast chemistry, you could do just simple chemical modeling and get an idea of what was happening. So we realized very early that, yeah, this could slow down the chemistry, but the models actually, we were surprised when you put it in the models, the way they were done, because they had limitations. I think they were still one-dimensional. The result was exaggerated. Mm-hmm. And that's what we didn't anticipate. We knew that, and then later it was sort of corrected.
So I'd like to talk a little bit more, if it's okay, about the sure. measurement group, or at least the change in instrumentation, mm-hmm. Your experience of it, or your familiarity with it. Because this is just barely more than a decade after Lovelock has made these initial
right.
measurements over
right.
the Atlantic, which is just a little more than a decade after he develops his electron
capture
detector.
Right, right.
So the way in which you're doing your work is being modified pretty rapidly by the changing instrumental community for this.
Right.
Or is it? Are you changing how you're doing your measurements and what you're able to measure and concentrations you're able to measure?
Yes, that was part of the creativity of the community there, and that goes back to what I was suggesting yesterday of a very striking interaction between fundamental basic science and, in this case, something applied, because this was a motivation to further develop these techniques. Otherwise, it was a sort of laboratory activity, but not receiving much emphasis. In fact, just to stress that, what was even more emphasis were the molecular beam experiments, because that was more sort of attractive or more fundamental, but not very practical for atmospheric research, because it had to be, the experiments are under very high vacuum and just with very simple species, so we had to do more sophisticated stuff. But that was very much pushed by the stratospheric things. But just to tell you a little bit about this, what Lovelock had done is analysis of very stable species, but in very small amounts. And so that was important, and similar techniques could be used to just bring air samples from the stratosphere to the lab and see how much, what was the concentration of CFCs and some of the other stable species. You can measure methane, nitrous oxide, and so on. But the bulk of the research in chemical kinetics, if you want, or atmospheric chemistry, was for the less stable species. So those require these different techniques, either spectroscopic techniques like resonance fluorescence, where you can measure very, very tiny amounts of some very reactive species, particularly, say, chlorine atoms or so, because they absorb very strongly at one particular wavelength. And that's what Jim Anderson used to measure the chlorine when he over Antarctica. And so, but that had been developed as a laboratory tool. And so that was one approach with flash photolysis. So you create these things and you follow it in a microsecond time scale. And the other approach was with flow tubes, where instead of looking at things on a very fast time, you flow things and you still have a very short time of reaction, if you want, but you didn't have to analyze at high speed, because you were creating a system where the time was just the flow time. But at any particular point in the tube, you could spend minutes if you wanted to analyze what was happening there. And with a movable injector, you could vary the reaction time and so on. So I started actually with one of the fields with flash photolysis, and in good measure, because my chemical laser work had been done with flash photolysis. But then it turns out that the more powerful technique for laboratory studies was the flow tube, and initially they only work at very low pressure. So one of the things we were able to do in our lab is to expand the range of operation of those to much higher pressures. But this had relatively little, if anything, to do with Jim Lovelock's approach, because we were using either optical spectroscopy or mass spectroscopy to do the analysis, okay, which is still require high sensitivity, but in a laboratory setup, as opposed to analyzing a complex mixture of chemicals, if you want, which might have many other chemicals, but you were able to selectively measure the CFCs. So so much of the laboratory work was all along these lines. And these techniques were developed essentially by the community. Some of us were pushed it further or even came up with a brand new idea, let's do it this or that other way, but some labs specialized in any one or other technique, but eventually we interacted with each other, if you want, and so we were able to slowly use better and better approaches, and then we had to be able to measure things at very low temperatures. Then eventually what became a big challenge, and we also were able to develop instrumentation to do it, is what we call heterogeneous reactions with no longer in the gas phase, either with small particles, or we could deposit things on walls and then measure the actual chemical rate of gas phase species with species that are liquid or solid. So that was the essence, if you want, of the push in laboratory chemistry, very closely coupled to field measurements, because they were very similar techniques in the balloons, airplanes, or in the lab.
Did you ever reach out directly to any of the instrument makers to ask them to make adjustments that would help you with the sort of questions you were looking to answer?
Not really, because these were mostly homemade.
Okay. Right.
Well,
okay.
The sort of things we could buy, of course, initially oscilloscopes or photon counters or so, but no, but these were all, essentially all the, or a mass spectrometer, okay, then you we could buy the end of it, but all the front was adapted to a flow tube in the laboratory. So, no, we had interactions with that. There were later, there were very good friends and so on, Chokolov and so on, who's, they had companies developing field instruments to measure particles and so on, but using essentially similar techniques to the ones we used. So if they were part of the community, and we, but no, we never had to sort of reach out other than to the people making more of the fundamental electronics, or perhaps the, for example, Fourier transform spectrometers. Okay, so that was one thing we could eventually buy. Of course, that we would not build that, but we had to adapt it and couple it to our lab experiments. So yes, but it's not something we sort of requested. Once it became available, then we used it just like lasers. Okay, there were a few companies developing lasers, and so when we were able to buy a few lasers just to be able to analyze optically certain types of species and so on. Mm-hmm. So just like general field lab research.
When developing these technologies for your, these instruments for your research, I mean, when I think of, you know, building something, I'm thinking of you need certain tolerances for what you're constructing. Things have to be built to a specific size.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Were you doing these builds yourself? Did you have someone in your lab that specialized in mm-hmm. these construction projects?
Okay, here is how I remember how it developed I'm just trying to remember where. Yeah, but it even started in Berkeley as a graduate student. If you are an experimentalist, then you learn, for example, we had two separate activities. That way, they were not really formally part of your graduate studies, in terms of a requirement for your degree, but they were very much part of your research. And one was to take a machine. I even forget the words now. We had to learn to build instruments. So we machine work with I forget all the names of these. Exactly. And so our task was to build certain pieces of instrumentation as part of the course. And so what we personally sort of mm-hmm. build that. That was quite important and useful. Because later on, of course, we wouldn't do that personally, and our students would do only a little bit, but we had professionals, machiners, and so you designed your instruments, and you could bring it to them, interact, and they would build whatever you designed. That's even more of a task for field measurements, because in that case, they have to be miniaturized, and the electronics has to be more sophisticated. But in the same way that we learned to machine tools and so on, we had to learn some electronics. Early on, we had to get into the boards and fix the boards. Later on, it was just a matter of replacing boards, so things change a lot. But we had to learn all sorts of things from how computers work and so on. So and then the other specialty was glass blowing also. So we had to learn to glass blow because things broke in the lab, you had to do it. But in general, you had to know enough so that you could go to the glass blower and have him build your special instruments. Okay, so that's, again, that's where field measurements and laboratory measurements had a lot in common, but it's not something you would order from a company. You would get from a company things that would be advertised, like in Physics Today, you see today, mostly the electronics, or sometimes they have, or lasers, or low temperature devices, coolers, or things of that sort. So you use what is available, commercially, you design your instruments, and it's very useful to have work yourself in with machining or with glass blowing, because then you can better design things that make sense. So that was very much part of the research.
I think part of my questioning comes from the fact that when thinking about technology today, there's a certain faith that technologies will work in a certain way over time, and no matter where you go, that same technology will replicate data the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're building your own instruments and gathering data that way,
mm-hmm.
it seems like there could be the potential for scientists to say, well, I don't believe your data because I've never used your device because you built your own device. Does that ever?
Not really. It's an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about it. Not really, because the idea, when your experiment is important enough, is the results can be reproduced. And so all these measurements, when they really matter, okay, for example, you come up with a rate constant. Maybe it was a very difficult one to measure, and then there's just one additional measurement, particularly if it's important. But more often than not, there are five or six measurements, and people might be using different techniques. So you don't necessarily have to depend on or to trust somebody's specific technique, because he reports it. Okay, say we use resonance fluorescence and so on, so you trust that he was able to build his laboratory machine to work. But what gives strength to the results is that it was reproduced with different techniques in different labs. But again, emphasizing that in a few cases it's difficult, so there just a few measurements are carried out, but almost never would I remember a case where if something really important was only done once in one lab. You wouldn't trust that very much for those reasons. Let me give you one little story here, but it's very much to the point. You know, this species I mentioned, chlorine peroxide, that is, we sort of made in the lab, we realized that was a key species to explain the Antarctic ozone hole. So we had to measure how fast does it decompose with photolysis, at what wavelengths, and so on. We did that early on. And there were a couple of other measurements, which were in the right range. And so these groups where we recommend results, we had, with some uncertainty, we recommended some results, that was fine. It turns out that years later, it was not that long ago, maybe after the Antarctic ozone hole, everything was already very well accepted. Of all places, at the Jet Propulsion Labs, one of my colleagues redid one of those measurements because it was important, and again, tried to identify chemical properties, photolysis rates, and so on, of these same species, chlorine peroxide. And they did what they thought was a very careful experiment and came up with unexpected results, namely that we're just finding it, this species is just much more stable than we had anticipated. So that's a big problem, because how the hell do we explain the Antarctic ozone hole then? That means there's some missing chemistry. What we thought was very well-established science, there's a problem. It made a lot of news, okay, particularly with skeptics and so on. And it took a couple of years, but then several labs did very sophisticated measurements showing they had done something wrong with mm-hmm. us. And so I didn't do that anymore, but Yuan Li, for example, a colleague, he's a Nobel Prize winner, he was not working with these sort of things, but he built some of the finest molecular beam instruments. So he did one of the measurements, and Jim Anderson did another set. So several well-known people took this as a challenge. They said, that's strange. And so they showed that who knows what went wrong with that JPL experiment. But it made news because it was a well-established group. One measurement showing that three or four were wrong. Okay, but it's possible because the three or four, maybe they were not careful enough because they had not subtracted this or that. Yeah, but then it got fixed. Then three or four key measurements, very clear, no, you guys. But this shows, what's interesting about this is how delicate the balance is. Okay, you do your research, you put everything together, and then you can explain what happened, but based on certain measurements in the laboratory where you reproduce what's happening in the atmosphere based on measurements of what's there in the atmosphere, and you put it all together and it makes sense. You know? So that's how science sort of moves. You know? But it's very much related to your question of instrumentation or trusting people or whatever.
One other small question I had, I kind of get a sense for what the answer to this is going to be, is some of the scientists I've spoken with, they care more about the data being generated in their lab. That's what they find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And are not necessarily, they are sometimes glad to be away from the bench.
Mm.
It sounds like you like being at the bench, and I'm curious why you like doing.
Well, what I liked, again, when I moved to JPL and so on, because it goes back to my childhood, if you want, doing experiments and finding something new and doing the measurements, it's sort of exciting and so on. And you have to be very patient, you have to design your experiments correctly. But then it's very satisfying when you get results, okay? So that's one activity. Another activity, some other people prefer to do that, is just computer models, okay? They don't touch the lab. But the main activity is just to put it all together and see that it makes sense. So then, what was even more rewarding, if you want, at MIT I had a big group then. So even though I was not personally doing experiments, but I was working with my students and making sure the instruments were right and so on, and then interacting with them. And so it's this joint creativity, if you want. And sometimes the students have their own ideas and we tested them. And so that's how research is done eventually. It's a group activity, if you want. But yeah, it's a matter of taste, whether you like to do it yourself or so. But eventually you have to, the important activities you have to rationalize, to put it in the context of known theory, and to write the papers and interact with your colleagues if you have to. So that's why sometimes, and it happens more and more often nowadays, you write joint articles even with groups that you don't know, that you never met, that are in Europe or so, and then you get a paper with all these authors because you are focusing on different aspects of a result that you are putting together, and it's just different ways to corroborate the science itself.
One thing I'd like to maybe hear a little bit more about, the Montreal Protocol.
Okay.
I mean, in some ways, I don't want to say that's the culmination of your scientific work,
mm-hmm.
but it can be thought of as the culmination of the public aspect of things that, I mean, 13
right.
years earlier.
Sure, sure.
So if you could talk a little bit about
sure,
that.
Sure, sure. The what happened is that it became clear once we had the science moving and so on that it was important to have an international agreement. Okay. So it was a precedent for what later with climate change and so on became better known. But the idea was, the components, if you want, was to create a group of experts that would meet maybe once a year or once every couple of years to write a report, a scientific report. And that's what preceded the IPCC. Okay, so, and it actually still goes on. I haven't participated recently with more, but we had the tradition of meeting in Switzerland in the Diablerie. Okay, so we put all the all the scientific papers, all the work, and you get all the experts together, and you summarize things in a report, which is like an IPCC report. Okay? And that's input that you then bring to the community of negotiators. Of course, you had to set that up, and it was set up with as a joint effort of the World Meteorological Organization and United Nations and so on. But there were a few key people there. Because negotiators, each country has to send their own and so on, so eventually comes a big part. But like Mustafa Tolba, who was an ambassador from Egypt there, he was very instrumental getting everything to work. And just like the IPCC has a chair, who's that now is Pachauri, a very good friend of mine. The chair before him of IPCC was Bob Watson, who was the chair before that of the stratospheric ozone chemistry groups. Bob was it's a very good friend. He was even at Berkeley at the same time. But he was a researcher at the Jet Propulsion Labs doing experiments in the lab. But then very early on, he decided he wanted to move to the policy aspects. Eventually, he was the chief scientist at the World Bank or whatever. But he was sort of the representing the scientific community, if you want, of course. That's why we worked very closely with him, working with people like Mustafa Tolba, and a few others. I have all those names there, who were the ones that pushed for an international agreement that eventually materialized in Montreal. They met several times. I went to a few of these meetings, but I was an active participant of the scientific reports, but I was sort of invited as almost as a courtesy, because I was not a professional negotiator, okay? And making statements about the science or whatever. So it was very interesting to observe this thing. And there were usually reporters there as well. And so it was an outreach effort. But that's how the Montreal Protocol came about. And in the first version, still relatively weak, just calling for reducing emissions in one half. And then when the Antarctic ozone hole, when everything became clear, I said, let's just ban it completely. And there are lots of interesting things happening. Initially, the European representatives were actually industry employees, which were very, very much against any regulation. But then Europe changed, and Margaret Thatcher was sort of among them. They took this as a... Margaret Thatcher was a chemist, actually. So they took this as something that of an interesting issue where they could make a point. And so it became a competition later on. So that was nice, because the US had dominated things before, and the Europeans said, okay, we are on board. And so there, it was remarkable that there was not much to fight against. The big difference with climate change being that there was this small number of chemical industries, DuPont leading, and as we were talking about, they had accepted the science, so there was no major objection to this. So that's how it all worked very well with different groups, but we were collaborating quite closely.
What role did you play in setting up the mechanics of how this would function?
Well, I was part of probably of the initial discussions of this. Of this group that would judge the science. However, what I remember distinctly, although I was sort of invited and participated, just like with the National Academy reports, being a member of the National Academy, I've been in a number of groups writing reports, but very specifically on the ones related to this problem, I was not in the group on purpose, because we were sort of the ones proposing this idea, so we're the ones being judged in some sense. And a little bit the same thing happened with the with the chemical reports. I was able to participate in things, but not on purpose. And Sherry did a very much a similar thing, helping and participating, but not in a dominant role, because the idea was not for that not to be perceived or not in practice being something that we were controlling, but we were just contributing to the science.
And so am I correct in saying that this is mostly being driven by the UN?
Yes,
And as as an organizational kind
Right. Because they are the ones that set up the rules, they asking each country to name representatives that would formally be accepted by the United Nations and then be part of the negotiations. Probably, as with many of these negotiations, the main components were done in the hallways or before, and then you had the formalities with everybody approving it and so on, but it's a very cumbersome way to actually work out details of them.
So I don't know to what extent you can answer some of this, because you were trying to play a slightly more distant role. But I have a couple of questions about the actual mechanics of it, because it does set up a model for how the international community can come together to talk about a global environmental issue that has a diverse set of sciences contributing to it.
Right.
And that it's going to do these consensus statements, and it's going to format their recommendations in a very specific way. And this gets replicated not just with climate change, but other groups try to replicate the same model, whether it's around endocrine disruption or other emerging issues. But where did that idea come from, that this was a way in which a vast amount of scientific evidence could be condensed, turned into very specific bulleted recommendations, kind of knowing their audience that policymakers aren't going to read a very technical report?
Yeah, as far as I can tell, we did not have a precedent here. There might have been, there were much more local precedents, okay? If you had a spill in the Rhine or local problem in the U.S., then you also have perhaps scientific groups. But that it was not the global United Nations effort. Mm-hmm. So as far as I can tell, this was the first global effort. It was sort of obvious, so in some sense it was a very reasonable thing to do, because we were also I remember the heads of the of UNEP and the WMO, people that we were in close contact with and were very good friends and so on. So we sort of designed these things. So it became a logical thing to do. We're not going to have the scientists negotiate. This has to be something done at the United Nations level. So we need to summarize the consensus. And so that's probably how this evolved. But there are not that many really global issues that have occurred with this. But again, perhaps out of some, the present might be environmental problems where several countries were involved, but not the entire planet.
So the Montreal Protocol gets, the story of it now is usually told as the exemplar of how the international community can come together in relatively quick time frame and act in a very decisive way to actually affect a problem.
Right.
So I have two questions. One is, did it feel like it was fast for you?
Well, not really, and here is why. Remember we were talking about before, there was this whole decade that we're with.
Right.
Well, the process started before the Antarctic Ozone Hole came about. So it was moving relatively slowly at the beginning. With the Antarctic Ozone Hole, then it became faster, but it took a decade. I don't know. It was not a very fast process. From some perspective, it was very fast according to some other perspective. They say, wow, you reached an international agreement, and it didn't take that long, so it's a matter of perception. But to me, it was very slow at the beginning, okay? Because we were meeting, but it wasn't clear, and that's when, again, I was telling you that many of the representatives were still heavily influenced by industry and say, okay, we meet, let's discuss that, but this might be very costly and we might lose a lot of jobs. Those were the objections, which all fortunately turned out to be not to be the case. We were all already working with people trying to analyze a problem at large, and within say, no, this is something society can deal with, and we're not going to stop using spray cans, let alone refrigerators and so on, of course. But there were some difficulties. I remember, but in very important presence, the president of the developed nations coming up with resources. They created the multilateral fund. The U.S. was reluctant for a while, saying, wow, this is a precedent. If we accept this, that means that we are going to have to be responsible in part with also on economic terms for possibly other issues. But I remember this was discussed, and eventually, okay, we'll do it. And that turned out to be very important to get the developing nations on board and to help. In that case, it was very clear. Spray cans were not used in many of the developing countries at all. So they had not put anything in the atmosphere, and yet they had to agree not to buy or use these chemicals, you could consider that, wow, this means giving up a potentially high standard of living under certain conditions. Fortunately, that's why the solution was very important. See, you don't have to lose your high quality standard of living, just do it correctly. You might be a little bit more expensive, but nowhere as expensive as if you don't worry about this and so on. And so those were the important precedents, if you want. And it's still working. The multilateral fund is still functioning, and they developed a sort of highly sophisticated way eventually of checking everything. It was not just a matter of, you have to check whether there are emissions, whether there are illegal imports, all sorts of things. So that system it's a whole community, if you want, that works there. Which I don't work closely with at all anymore. I sort of I was invited, obviously, to the 20th anniversary or so recently, as I gave a speech, and it was all very nice and so on. And but the issues now are more, to what extent should climate change also be incorporated to the Montreal Protocol and so on. But essentially all the other issues have been more or less resolved.
Sorry, to interrupt you really quickly. I think an important fact is that Mexico was the first country to ratify the document and the first country to give a calendar for reducing emissions. So I think, you have had to play a big part.
That's right, yeah, I forgot about that.
That's just right. In case
Mexico was very active. Sure, because I was, of course, close to the government at that time already. Yeah. But the U.S. was very positive at that time also. Yeah.
So my only other question on that is, what made that possible?
I think the science was very sound. And it became clear that replacements could be designed, and some of them were already there, ranging from similar chemicals, but that would affect the ozone less or not at all, two completely different chemicals like hydrocarbons instead of CFCs or so. So solutions were sort of realistic at hand in some way, not terribly costly, and very clear signs. So it's a risk that obviously there are always some uncertainties, but who has a clear argument that we shouldn't do this? Nobody, there was no, there might have been always these crazy opinions in some newspapers, but with that we still see with climate change, of course, with a complete lack of understanding of what was happening, just attributing everything to just governments trying to pursue control over people's lives, that the typical thing started already there. But that was relatively minor. It didn't have any major impact because, okay, the another important component was that the world leaders decided to work together. Okay, they didn't have to fight each other. They were more rather competing to see who would do more. And so if you have approval all the way to the top and approval from industries, I think that made it quite practical. And what happened with climate change, perhaps, but what could have been a big barrier is developing countries saying, hey, no, we're not sure. We want to be able to use these compounds because they give us a high quality of life. But that fortunately did not happen because our alternatives were offered and some financial help as well. Lots of these things, of course, as you know, I'm very involved with climate change issues now, so that's that. A lot of these things are quite interesting as to contrast with what's happening now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think this might be a good point to transition to your time at MIT.
Okay. Okay.
And the first question I have is, what precipitated that move?
Well, I decided to, after I had done a few years experiments in the lab myself and so on, I decided that the academic life was something I could enjoy. I had learned some of that, of course, when I was at Irvine, and just to get to have a somewhat greater impact and hence more satisfaction in terms of my contribution to the field. Okay. So it was not no longer just my personal contribution doing experiments in the lab, but getting more involved also with some of the larger issues, both scientifically and perhaps even connected, beginning to be more connected with policy issues. Although at that time it was not that clear, but I thought I could have MIT, a much larger group, and have more scientific publications, simply be more productive. Okay? And I would just give up, but I thought that it's fine now, just doing the experiments with my own hands, as we were talking about before. If I wanted, I could have. I still did some of that with my students, but clearly if you have 15 students, you're not, the idea is they do the bulk of the experiment, but you meet with them and you discuss them. Even the teaching itself, I realized, okay, it's something I actually enjoyed. It's a challenge, and we sort of improvised. We are not trained to teach and so on, but it's a very good way to learn in spite of the students. So then with MIT, with a smaller group, it was much more interactive, and I could already visualize that. So it was just a very attractive thing to do then, to move up in the academic environment, if you want, just to have more of an impact in the atmospheric, or rather in the, not just atmospheric, in the environmental chemistry type field.
So knowing that you were gonna perhaps have access to a larger workforce and some more funding, what were the big questions you wanted to be able to turn your attention towards?
Well, I was, there were still, I don't remember exactly how far, this was just about the time that the Antarctic ozone hole and all that was being settled, so there were still important chemical questions that remain to be answered in more detail, reactions with on surfaces, so I started to do a lot more of that type of work. And I remember also at that time already beginning to worry about the much more complicated chemistry lower down, like in Mexico City or so. So just expanding the with the sophisticated techniques we had learned to use with a much simpler stratosphere, see how much more could we learn about a more complicated chemistry lower down, which is also an environmental problem and requires a lot of science. So it's more dealing with more complex systems. That would be the one way to look at it and interact with other professors and so on. And I had a joint appointment in the chemistry lab of in the Earth Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences, where I would also work more closely with the modelers. Mm-hmm. So it was more of an expansion of vision, if you want.
So I think it might actually, I don't know if this sounds like a good idea. I do want to ask about you receiving the Nobel.
Okay, tonight. Okay.
In some ways, I think of that as, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want to say the end, but you know, if you're moving into the lower atmosphere for your mm-hmm. research, maybe finishing off with what happened in the upper atmosphere mm-hmm. and this recognition of your mm-hmm. work, maybe talk a little bit about that and then get into more detail about you know, the joint project between MIT and the Mexico City
okay.
government and
yeah.
maybe go in that order if that makes sense.
Sure. Okay. Again, I have to review the timing a little bit. I'll do that afterwards, and so if there's something to clarify, I'll let you know. But as I remember, the first years at MIT were still very much an extension of the sort of more focused laboratory work I had done with a very small group at JPL, but still working on the more complicated problems in still in the stratosphere or even in the upper troposphere, okay, getting with slightly more complicated chemical systems and more complicated instrumentation as well. But it was not the big, well, the Nobel Prize came in between, I think. But the change, I'll come back to that in a moment, but the change in really say, okay, let's worry about pollution in Mexico City. That was a very explicit effort that came out of discussions at MIT with colleagues in other disciplines, because at that time I was already doing what I was telling you about in terms of interactions with the policy people, with people, the experts in negotiation in the Department of Urban Studies and things of that sort, because MIT has a program where they give PhDs or masters in these disciplines where you have a scientific background but you work more on the practical sort of societal problem. But we got together, I've been familiar with that part of the problem, and they said, how can we do more about this to better train students, namely find a problem which it's essential for the students, even though they have to keep their own discipline and be experts without losing any depth in knowledge in their own discipline, but be exposed to all the aspects required to solve a societal problem, which means they would have to learn a little bit about policy issues, about economic issues. In environmental chemistry, for example, here they would have to interact also with epidemiologists or the medical community, because that's the impacts that they would have, and with energy sources and so on. So you have to have a sort of picture of how the whole thing functions. Mm-hmm. And so we decided, let's pick a problem, and being from Mexico and so on, and air pollution in Mexico City being a big problem, said, hey, it's not a bad idea. Let's focus on air pollution in Mexico City, because it's a complex problem, requires lots of things. And I had access Because I, although I was certainly not working in Mexico, except marginally at that time, I had good friends. I was in touch with government people, and it became feasible because there was an organization, Comisión Ambiental Metropolitana, and it was some sort of a joint venture which had funding, and that was what was important, dealing with air pollution in Mexico City, but not knowing very well what, or not having perhaps the right science component. Anyhow, all these things go together, and that's how I sort of switched really to, in terms of my own work in the laboratory, more focused on these sort of things. But the students, for the students, it worked very well, because my own students, of course, they still had to do their own laboratory work and learn chemistry or whatever they had to do without losing any depth there. And the same thing with the urban studies people, or with the MIT does not have a medical school, so we collaborated with Harvard's public health school and so on. And so we have very close relations with all that. And there were students that were, in some sense, this program I was telling about was an overview of that. So they were involved with the policy aspects of these issues. And then, so we organized it so that the students had to do a joint model, if you want. They had to work a model involving atmospheric chemistry, physics, but health impact, and some economic costs, and so on. And the fact that they had to come up with some results, not just talk to each other, but some results, it functioned extremely well for the students to collaborate with each other. Okay. And so in some sense, that's how my interest changed. And then after that, I decided, well, I'm doing so much in Mexico, I might as well come to Mexico and create a center here. And so, but that happened much later. Coming back to the Nobel Prize, if you want, there was just a few years after I got to MIT, so I was still doing this basic research, moving more to heterogeneous chemistry and so on. And I've just been surprised. I remember being quite surprised because some people have mentioned I was on some list, but I mean, I thought it was not a very serious comment. But yeah, so I got a call from Sweden, and so I remember that call because Henning Rorek is a good friend of mine. He's also an atmospheric scientist, and I knew him. But he happened to be a member of the Royal Academy in Sweden. So when I first got the call from the president of the society, but Henning Rorek came on the call afterwards and said, "Yeah, this is Sweden. This is correct." So anyhow, that's how it happened, and it did. What that did, of course, to me is first, of course, being very happy and very honored or whatever, but then slowly sort of realizing, looking at other Nobel Prize winners, this has the other side of the coin. It's a little bit like a responsibility. Okay, how can you use your visibility, your convening power, and do more things than just your own personal laboratory work? And so the Mexico, that's how the Mexico City experience was reinforced, if you want, with the Nobel Prize, because perhaps that's why I could also have a closer interaction with the groups here in Mexico and get access to the funding that they had, they managed to get from a small surprise on gasoline, just 1 or 2 cents or whatever they were able to. That was a lot of money. Not meant just to do research, but for public transport projects or whatever. So that was enough resources for us to get this project started.
And you also used some of the Nobel Award, the money, to establish a scholarship program?
That's right. That was, of course, not directly connected with this work, but that was just some part left at MIT, still there, and some part here with the Mexican government, fortunately in both cases with the idea that, I mean, after all, it's personal money, it's not a lot, but we were able to use it to get additional resources. So we got here some resources from the government and MIT from other donors. So essentially these were scholarship programs that are still there, no? That they're still working.
It's also during the time that you're at MIT in this period generally that you also become U.S. President's committee, a member of the Committee of Advisors on Science and Technology.
Right. That came a little later, sure. That was with Bill Clinton.
In 94, yeah. Right. Yeah. So you were with Clinton till the end, then there's a gap.
Right.
With Bush, and then you're back on with Obama.
Right.
And also, during this period of time, a little bit after the Nobel, you became a member of the board of directors of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
That's right.
Is this all sort of your general movement towards the public policy?
Yes, in some sense, the Union of Concerned Scientists was I have to remember his name, a good friend, another Nobel Prize winner who created the Union of Concerned Scientists, who tragically died in a diving accident much later. But he was, again, just like myself, trying to do things for society, for the environment, so it was very logical to accept this invitation and being part of that. And then, of course, later I became a member of a few other boards and so on, but in general would have been the same direction. But just to tell you a little bit more about this is PCAST with Clinton. The first 4 years, Clinton was not particularly interested in science because he delegated it all to Al Gore. Al Gore was the environmentalist, and I had worked with him before because he was a senator for Massachusetts, so we had met on several occasions. But fortunately, the second term, they were like, well, it's not enough for the vice president in the U.S. You really need the president. Fortunately, Bill Clinton himself became very much an environmentalist. Maybe a little bit too late, he couldn't get too much done anymore, but he went to our meeting, so that was very positive and quite interesting, besides Al Gore, of course. And then with President Bush, of course, we're not there. And then again, of course, with President Obama.
So you weren't there because you...
Well, two things happened. I was not invited, but I didn't make any move to try to get invited. What happened is that group persisted, but it was very heavily an industrial group. And these groups only work if the president himself has some affinity for the group or for science advice. And it turned out it didn't have much. It was there, but it didn't do. And President Bush was not well known neither for his interest for science or for environmental issues or so on.
But it's also during his presidency that Gore comes out with An Inconvenient Truth.
That's right. That's what, of course, if you remember, Gore lost the presidency close, and so he did, that was sort of quite heavy for him. I mean, quite a difficult thing to live through. But then eventually, of course, I continued interacting with him, but not nearly as closely as we did when he was vice president.
So what was the atmosphere like when you came back, rejoined PCAST in 2009?
Well, for some reason, President Obama is quite interested and pays a lot of attention to science. And so from the beginning, we were able to meet with him and had quite a bit of interaction. But, as expected, these were politically very difficult times, and so his political advisors, of course, had the last word in terms of what to do about climate change was the big issue from my perspective, but other issues, of course, we were able to, and still working very hard on STEM education and restoring innovation through the development of scientific research, science or so, in the U.S. the enterprise system. And the health, of course, the health issue was, as you know, was in some sense, some critics say, well, Obama could only do one thing at a time because that's the nature of the power in presidency, and so he chose to do health, and he could have chosen perhaps on the environment, but with a Republican Congress, extreme opinions would have been extremely hard. But the point is, the first 4 years were still a lot of work, very productive, but not in climate change. Okay? And so now we just got started, and it's much more of an opportunity because there's no more political pressure, but Republican Congress is still there, of course, so we can do quite a bit short of an international agreement, which is what's really needed. And sort of things on focusing more and more, of course, besides what we do here in Mexico with the Mexican government, is, again, communication with the public, but with politicians as well, including the hope of communicating with some, not the extreme version, but of course we get along very well with former Republicans, but with current Republicans there are a few that we might be able to get close to. But it's a whole specialty. In spite of my experience with Santos Pericoso, it was extremely helpful. The difference now is the realization this is really a profession. This is something that to learn from others that do this profession. So you have to be even more flexible in how to communicate to the public and so on. So those are the more recent activities related to PICAS, if you no well no. I should separate this. With PICAS, we do whatever is reasonable, whatever we can do, but it's strictly outside politics. Okay. But this communication with the public is something to do just like I did early on my activities with Stratospheric Ozone.
So I want to come back to the Nobel. I didn't want to
stop
the threads that we were moving forward. Would you describe the award as a surprise or as a pivotal change in your career, or in your short description when we first asked, you're very nonchalant about getting a call from Sweden and being told that you're getting the Nobel Prize. Maybe I believe that that's the way you really are. But I'm wondering if there was any sense of closure or if this felt like,
Not closure. It's not as I'm finally rewarded for what I deserved. No, it for some that just didn't cross my mind, because I was already very satisfied with one rewarded because the Montreal Protocol had been achieved. So I thought, okay, we were very lucky. We found this problem, and then we were able to actually get something done by society at large. So that part was done. So the Nobel Prize is not really on politics, but just on science. So it was obviously very rewarding, but not something I was expecting in any way. Furthermore, the part of the surprise was because there were practically no precedents for Nobel Prize in environmental issues. Okay? Mm-hmm. They're all very fundamental scientific work. Of course, this was coupled. This had some of that. But it was an environmental problem. So that's very rare. There had been something very early on connected with the atmosphere, but not with the environment. Okay, so it was not sort of unexpected not to expect a Nobel Prize for the sort of work that we did. There might be other prizes where, of course, now there are more and more where they focus more on the environmental components. So that's why it was a surprise. But then I realized, wow, this does change your life in some way because of the attention that you receive. And I was already moving to this, to having a broader perspective on on the issues, and so this just helped and made an even stronger point. And then as I, over the next few years, knowing the other Nobel Prize winners, that I realized that they really changed field. Of course, many of them received the prize many years after they had done their research, but many changed. They devoted themselves to education or to something or other. There are relatively few that go back and do the same thing they were doing for which they received the prize. So that was normal. But again, it's just it's more like an opportunity,
mm-hmm.
or even a responsibility in some sense. That's how it worked. It's still very rewarding, but decided, wow, it's I could easily waste this opportunity if I don't do anything, okay, just sit back and and retire, sort of. Fortunately, say, I now have a number of students that I was able to work with, particularly in my MIT years, that have done very well as professors in the academic community. So in some sense, I feel, okay, I did create my own school, and they are doing the sort of research I could be doing. So that it sort of doesn't make sense to be even competing with them to do this, the same type of research. Let me tell you, one of the scientific things that was also very rewarding, in this dealing with Mexico's air quality, of course, it was, again, very rewarding because we were able to impact decision makers in government and so the set of regulations and air quality was pretty bad. And so it actually improved quite a bit, not just because of what we did, because it was a logical thing for society to do, but not all major cities are doing that, okay? So it took some effort. But we were able to organize a number of smaller sort of experiments, but two major sort of field experiments, even if we did not have many resources, but because we had access to the system, we could invite some of the major research groups in these fields to bring their own instruments and so on, and so to do a 1 or 2 month very intense field study of a very polluted city, because that was an opportunity to learn a lot about how this complicated chemistry works, which would be harder to do in a clean city, okay? Mm-hmm. It was easier with big signals. And so those two field studies, which involved millions of dollars, but again, not ours, but just the research money was out there, where it's just, at least symbolically, also very rewarding, something where we were able to push the science, very applied science of complex systems in this case, but that is hopefully has been very useful also to understand pollution and see the chemistry down here is much more complicated. We have bigger molecules, so you have to deal with it not at a very fundamental level, but some of it is more an engineering or a complex system approach, but there's a lot to learn what really matters, what should you emphasize. Ironically, some of the very recent developments in climate change is to make a much closer tie with air quality issues, because some of the black carbon and methane, some of the compounds that matter for air quality also matter for climate change. And so the sort of science that we were able to push, for example, is very helpful for these sort of things as well. But I forget what was the question. I sort of died.
No, you were fine. It was just around the prize as a pivotal moment.
Okay.
Yeah,
that these are all things that were enabled, if you want, by the prize in some sense. I could mention that my problem, if at all, is being interested in too many things, okay? Because to solve a problem like air pollution or climate change and so on, there are many disciplines, so you have to learn to sort of summarize important aspects of many of these disciplines, but also to be able to communicate with people in these different disciplines. So that's a challenge, but it's very wide. So economics, for example, is very important. That's why here we're in this center, we're pushing that very hard. But I'm also quite interested in education, for example. So that's just a side issue. But I was a professor so many years, and so I'm trying to help and push that to some extent, and advising a group here that it's connected more to the STEM education efforts in PCAS, because there are new ways, new pedagogical systems that are much more efficient, starting with elementary school and then all the way to college, the online stuff, not because it's online, but because you get the students to get very much more involved in what they're doing by being active. And I mention this as an example because one of my Nobel Prize colleagues, a friend of mine, Carl Wieman, who got his prize as a physicist working with single atom physics or so, he switched fields, so his field is education. So his expertise is in these new systems at college level. Here in Mexico, it turns out we have a big program but at elementary school level, but with the same ideas. Mm-hmm. Why do I mention it? It's just an example, something I could spend my full time, but it's mm-hmm. there are just so many things to do. So we do this part of our activities here, have to do something with education. But the challenge is to focus on something you feel you can have an impact on do the best you can. And here again, that's where the Nobel Prize is something to take advantage of, in that you have a more convening power. Okay, people perhaps listen more to you, but you have to be very careful. There's the other side of the coin is the expectation that you become an expert on everything in general. No, we are experts on just a few things, and perhaps we have a broad perspective on certain issues, but only if we put enough work in those issues to deserve that, if you want, that appreciation. But it's not automatic by any means. But anyhow, the Nobel Prize is indeed a big event.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you learned a lot of what you've done through experience, and I'm wondering what you tried to train into your students when you were at MIT.
Okay. In on the one hand, of course, the research itself is like the experience I had when I was at Berkeley is fundamental, just to give them the room to be creative and to understand things at the deeper and deeper level whenever they can, and to contribute to the advancement of science in very, very general terms. So, and that's why it's rewarding when you see that they respond and they learn, and you are forming people that can contribute a lot. But then there is this other aspect that I was telling you, to work with the other disciplines. And so what we realize, it's important to, if you can, to train students to appreciate, not just to appreciate, to be able to communicate with experts in other disciplines. Because the normal tendency we have is to teach a very narrow language so that your students and you yourself, you communicate with experts in your own field, but you develop a language so nobody else understands you, sort of. Why not learn and have a better perspective of societal problems, better perspective of what it takes to have an impact in real life? Realizing some students are going to just remain in academia, do their own things, but many others perhaps will branch out and have, maybe will go to even government positions and so on and so forth. So it is, I think this perhaps is somewhat connected with this education component I was telling you about, in that it's quite feasible to take advantage of the sort of scientific culture we have in the international scientific community, which is not just to be a good scientist, but you have also some values, okay? The values are, for example, honesty. And you know, it's because if you cheat, you're going to be caught most likely, and then you don't. But you do it not just out of worry that you're going to be caught. You develop a culture, which is what you would like to communicate to your students. You have to work in a certain way that it's honest. You also have to worry about, if you have choices, something that will benefit other people as well. And so these are the sort of things you can communicate quite well in a university. But if you don't worry about them, they might happen or might not happen. It's just by chance.
I have questions about training. In some way, maybe this is a poor characterization of it, but in some ways what I'm hearing is that graduate level students in science need to be trained not just as scientists, but as scientific citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But there's also, I think, something in there, and I don't know if you said to spoke about it specifically, but you know, in thinking about what you said yesterday about your teachers in
mm-hmm.
school, there's also this apparent need to have those teaching science
mm-hmm.
also be scientists. And how, I mean, do you have any thoughts about how that should be addressed more broadly? I mean, you said you had it as a criticism of the educational system in Mexico.
Right.
I've heard that as a criticism of the educational system in the U.S. as well, right? You have non-scientists
right.
teaching science. So
right.
how do you get past that?
Okay, that's a very, it's not an easy question, but let me give you some ideas. First, the only thing I would, going to the beginning of the question, I would expand it, is ideally you do that not only with graduate students. At MIT we had an important program called Europe, Undergraduate Research Opportunities. So you get upper division students, you try to integrate them into a research group already, precisely so that you can communicate with them these sort of things we're talking about. So it's not just graduate students. It's so important that we think it should be part of undergraduate training as well, to the extent that you can, because then they see how the teamwork functions and how creativity works and so on. So that not just listening or memorizing things, okay? In terms of experts, what is clear is that's to be expected at the university level. Okay, there you want people ideally who are doing research, who are creative, and who are real experts in their own field, and not just beginners, if you want, what might have happened to me when I was in college. But in high school and at undergrad, you cannot expect everybody to be a scientist, but at least to be well-trained in science. Okay. And we, of course, we see that in Mexico, but also in the U.S. There's the job as a teacher and so on. In some countries, perhaps Finland, and so a few exceptional countries, they are so highly rewarded that they are at the top of society, but not in the U.S. and Mexico. And so you end up having, in elementary school, teachers teach everything, including science, when they themselves did not have anything like a satisfactory science instruction. Okay, so they are bound to not teach well. So you need two things. You need the pedagogical tool and so on, but you also need to understand what you're teaching about. And the challenge here, it's one of the things one learns, is it's a challenge to simplify things. You have to understand things very well to be able to express them in simple terms, and that goes all the way to elementary school. So ideally you have well-motivated teachers. These programs I was telling you about that we are involved in, they get a lot of help. It was developed initially by national academies, but a very important component is to prefer the teachers themselves. Okay, so the teachers learn a lot. And one, so that's important. for obvious reasons that you cannot judge or teach something you don't really understand, okay? But that's very common, particularly in the sciences, or even, I remember the history teachers I had, well, they might have been very good in terms of memorizing names and so on, but what is very interesting is what's a historical perspective, the sociological, and that's not all that common or trivial. That's why I hated history in high school. It was just memorizing names and dates. And it's the same thing happens with chemists. That's the symptom of that is that chemistry is awful for most students. It's just something, wow, chemistry, I dislike that so much. I didn't understand. I had to, or even math, okay? You could make, even math could be quite attractive if you teach it in an interesting way and so on. But yeah, that's the challenge for teaching, but it goes all the way to college.
So I want to make sure we spend, I know we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to make sure we spend some time talking about the post-MIT years and your co-founding of both the center that we're in here in Mexico City and your move to San Diego, and thinking about those, what you wanted to accomplish moving here. And just in case, I don't know what role they'll play, but I think one of the pieces that I've been hearing for the last 2 days that I at least want to put out there, and maybe they'll work into some of what is happening here, are these larger conceptual changes that are happening. I mean, you've been very focused on kind of very specific problems that you've been addressing and very specific technical work that you've been doing, but there was a lot of knowledge shift, cognitive shift, you know, kind of larger epistemic shifts going on that you were a part of, that, you know, thinking about the earth as a system.
Right, right.
That changed a lot of how, you know, the space in which you could do your work and the work that you were doing was changing that.
Right.
The idea that the atmosphere is an open laboratory and that it's not just putting species of chemicals out there, but that the species that are out there are themselves having reactions that are out of our control. So the idea of secondary organic aerosols and thinking about you know, the things that are out there that we hadn't thought about before. So there's a lot of other pieces at play, and I don't know, it seems like when you came here, you know, your time at MIT and then your transition here to the Mario Molina Center and the position at San Diego gave you a chance to start thinking about some of the larger, more complex systems.
Right.
So anyhow.
Let me give you a few general ideas. What I wanted to do is to have time to open the center, but to remain in the U.S. as well because of being in PCAST and so on and remain part of the academia there and so on. So it had to be a compromise. And it was difficult to do that at MIT because MIT doesn't like to have part-time people, if you want. But they didn't want to let me go, and I have lots of very close connections with them still. But not being a part-time professor, I had that opportunity in the University of California, which I was at the beginning. So they were willing to say, okay, it's all right. We know you're not going to be here a full-time professor doing research. It's okay. You can spend time in Mexico, but hopefully you can contribute here as well. And fortunately, I think that has worked because what I tend to do in San Diego is a more scientific component. So we do have an important effort there, first I brought my MIT students that had not finished their PhD, so they did their experimental research still while I was in San Diego, so that's why I still had a lab there. But I decided to close it and not to take new students, but just to collaborate with other groups. But there is a very important research effort looking of all things at atmospheric particles, but in the lower atmosphere. Okay, that's one of the main uncertainties still in climate change science, if you want. So I collaborate with several faculty, and we're trying to get now a large NSF-funded center to do that. So the science is very exciting and keeps moving, but I'm no longer sort of with my own group doing that. I advise students and collaborate. It's a challenge, excuse me. It's a challenge, but as far as I can do it, I'll try to remain active in a scientific field. Okay? But there is these educational issues, but they are not necessarily an important part of my activities in San Diego. They are more part of the other things I do. Here in Mexico, there is the specific activities of this center, if you want, is mostly in connection, to begin with the Mexican government, but we're beginning to have interactions and impacts with the rest of Latin America as well, for logical reasons. But in between those, there are the larger sort of complex system issues, climate change, and how do you get things to happen? Specifically in this center, the goal was to see, can we impact the way society functions? For example, if we want to have an impact on the air quality issue, well, it's not going to be enough to write papers. It's a very challenging objective, but we will only consider we succeeded if the air quality actually improves. And maybe it improves on its own, but it certainly will improve because of many activities, but we can tell where we helped. And because air quality is sort of a bigger issue, but we were able to interact very closely with people here in government itself and have changed the regulations and things that renew the fleet, emphasize public transport, all sorts of things. So what we're doing more and more now, perhaps connected also with climate change, not just with air quality or the combination, is working with the Mexican government here, but with that overarching goal, very ambitious, if you want, that is, if we succeed, things will change. Mm-hmm. No, we don't want to just write reports, because we could do that at the university or so. That's a big challenge. That's where you need this broader perspective, because it's not enough to be a good scientist there. You need to understand how does society function. What are the political pressures? And then if there is corruption somewhere here, how can we get around it? If you understand how something, if you want to fix something that is not working, you really have to understand how is it working now, what are the difficulties, and you have to be very creative. Can I work with people elsewhere to change the system? So a sort of general rule that we end up using is, which it's something that goes back to MIT, if you want, with this, these negotiation courses that came up from Urban Studies and also from Harvard, is you get the stakeholders on the same table. Okay, so this just means, from the beginning, we want to solve a problem. We get people from government, the key people to work with us, from the private sector, if necessary, from society, and we don't write a report and tell them this is what you have to do. We organize activities in such a way that this comes out of the group. Okay, but nevertheless, all these challenges I was telling you about are there. So this is a very different thing than fundamental science, because it involves understanding how does society function, but not in any theoretical way that you could be doing at the Department of Sociology in some universities. It's the very practical way, how does society function, okay? And so we've learned enough, so we have succeeded in doing certain things, and we're trying to use that some challenges are very big. We have to choose things that are feasible, and we're still working on many others that are, fortunately, we do have close connections with government and also with the private sector, okay? Here is, we were talking before about extreme environmental organizations, okay? This is something that wouldn't work there. If you come out as an advocate pushing the environment at all costs, then you're not going to be able to work with with the private sector. Okay. You have to talk to them, you have to convince them that it's not just good for society, but if you do it in a creative way, you know, it's good for the for their success as well. For the country, you climate change issues and so on, it's good for the economy. Okay, so it's you cannot count on just sort of values of people being very good citizens. No, you have to be very practical and think, okay, this is the way society will improve. So that's a big challenge to understand all these issues and to be able to communicate them. We have one example I'll give you, which it's one project that we have more or less succeeded. It's housing. Mm. Okay, why housing? Well, for environmental issues, climate change and so on, you could build, you could name it green housing or some much more efficient housing than you could otherwise if you don't worry about it. Okay, but that's not enough. So we, turns out we got together with a private business of the private sector, several large companies whose business is to build houses. And they were in making all sorts of mistakes because their business was to buy land wherever was cheapest and then with government money to build the houses, and then they got the money. And it turns out many of them are abandoned because they are or very far or not agreeable or whatever. So things were very wrong. Okay, what do we do? Well, let's sit together. We get the industry people, but we get the government people too, because there are government institutions that do that. We provide the environmental expertise if you want, because there is all sorts of literature. How can you build much better insulated houses? And in the end, they are cheaper because you save energy. So we have a system where we work not just the environmental issues, but the economic and the social issues. So these people are now building housing developments which are much more attractive. First of all, they are in places where it makes sense, but then they build schools, they build... So the social component is crucial, okay? How do they succeed? And then the government has to provide incentives. Okay, and regulations, otherwise you have the free rider, somebody's going to take advantage of that. And this is working very well. So what we did here is provide the measure, we quantify that, and so we it's like giving a grade, but the point is not to grade how well they're doing now, but where should they move to? So we measure the social component, the economic component, the environmental component, with many different measures, and so it gives them a very clear guide how to move. But it's just one example. They are very happy, government is happy, we are improving things, and so it can be done. Mm-hmm. The public sector, the transportation sector is similar. It's a big challenge because normal people, everybody wants to have cars, so you have more and more cars and things get worse and worse. So you have to put barriers to the use of cars, and that's very difficult because you have to convince society that that's not good for them. Mm-hmm. But in New York, okay, you don't have everybody driving their own car to work, okay? So there are good examples. Mm-hmm. This can, but you need very good public transportation. So you have to be clear. See, how the hell do I manage to change the course of that things are moving on to, which is every day more congestion, spend hours getting to work, more pollution. Well. Yes, but we have to this enormous barrier of convincing people not to use their cars. So anyhow, these are just examples of the enormous challenges that require you to have just a much broader perspective of the problems. But you can't forget that there's a very strong technical component, the best practices. Okay, well, how can you build better houses? Well, there are these advanced technologies, you can, and so on, and they have to be cheap, and with cars and public transportation, you have to be aware of what's the state of the art, and so on. So the other challenge is to make sure that we don't use obsolete technologies, or that we take advantage of things that are working elsewhere. So there's a very important technological, and if you want, scientific component here as well. Okay, so you have to put it all together. So that's the the challenge here in the center. And in I was talking also about more general climate change. That's a political issue that sometimes we have to begin to work with communication experts. See, one simple idea here. It's very clear in the scientific community that there is practically, it's not unanimous, but almost 97% of experts in climate change agree. Hey, climate is certainly changing, and it's most likely, not absolutely certain, but it's most likely something that humans are causing. There are a few scientists that deny that, but it's actually a lot less than 1%. And we know very well why they are saying that, and the science behind that. So it's nothing, it's not that we totally ignore them, but they are libertarians, or they pick certain, we know science is not perfect, you can always find problems, but they don't affect the overall picture. Anyhow, that's very clear. But if you, surveys show that, and certainly the politicians, almost everybody thinks, oh, some scientists tell us it's this way, but there are many others. So science is not settled, so we shouldn't do anything about it. No, that's completely wrong. Mm-hmm. So we need to make, but if we write an op-ed or a scientific paper, nothing happens. You have to do something very well focused if you want to change the public opinion on this specific aspect. Extreme events are, anyhow, that's a whole scheme, but that's another important component of my interest, if you want, which is not specifically part of the, either the San Diego or the activities here at the center, but it's part of the overall effort, because we certainly want Mexico is one of the leaders in the climate change, in the political arena, in the developing world, okay? Because fortunately, President Calderon was very interested. I was able to work with him quite closely. And so it's something, there's a climate change law here in Mexico, so but you have to be realistic, of course, not to do something that backfires with the economy. But what I'm sort of saying is we have some very specific goals here in projects, energy, housing, transportation, and so on. And then there are these broader political issues that are less tractable, but nevertheless crucial to solve the overall problem eventually. So so you see how you have to sort of look at the big picture. That's one another way to look at it.
Well, but it sounds like it's more than just looking at the big picture. It sounds like your challenge and what you're trying to do with these multiple roles is you have to keep an eye on the big picture, but you have to look for the small focused project that you can do without having to tackle the entire big picture.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know if you want to share any thoughts on the difference between that experience and the Montreal Protocol. I mean, I think, you know, most folks who say, you know, the Montreal Protocol was this great example of everybody coming together, but there seemed like there was this direct route into how to fix things.
Yeah.
And it's not quite the same way with climate change.
Right.
But it is an aggregate of
right.
a lot of other potentially right. solvable issues.
Right. You described it just right. We were lucky in some sense with the Montreal Protocol that it was it could be a much more focused issue. We got a lot of help from the community, and so obviously the science turned out to be crucial, so that worked. But if you look coming around something completely different, much more local, air pollution in a city like this, well, there it's not just the science of air pollution. There the challenge is, which with the Montreal Protocol, it was setting the United Nations, which we did with not ourselves, but it was an effort of the community. But here, we would start, it's not that we did everything ourselves, but we would start talking to the key people, getting the right funding, giving key ideas, and then making sure they get incorporated into the local regulations. Okay. So in some sense, this sort of thing is more challenging, although it's smaller and more so, because we were set up to do the Montreal Protocol,
right.
I think. But it was a nevertheless an important experience to see what it takes to do these sort of things, okay?
Yeah.
And to see, well, there are economic barriers and things. You have to do things in such a way that society will accept them. And in the case of air pollution, yeah, it's just like with climate change. When the city was very polluted, then the society itself gave a clear message to the government, you have to fix this. But once it's not very polluted, it's no longer on the table, then it's harder.
I think you just ended perfectly. We have about 5-10 minutes. I don't know if you want to take pictures or...
No, I think we'll just wrap up.
Yeah.
I could talk to you for hours more. So thank you very much for the time you've shared with us the last 2 days.
If something else comes to mind or so, we can certainly do something over the phone or look at the written things. Okay.
Perhaps we could even get you on a train up to Philadelphia the next time you're at a PCAST meeting.
Okay, sure. Oh, okay, I forgot.